Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today, we're talking about faith in Appalachia and listening to some stories of what it's like to practice religion in the mountains. A 91-year-old man recalls being baptized in a river when a revival came to town.
Baptized us, and man, it was cold as all get out. I thought I was going to
freeze. What time of the year would that have been?
I don't remember now, but I know I like to froze.
And a girl finds out just how important her faith was after her father was in a mining accident.
It's hard to keep the faith in situations like that, but you kind of have no other choice. It's like you have your faith or you have nothing. And I'd rather have my faith than have nothing.
And a rabbi remembers the first time he visited West Virginia.
We're walking down the Kanawha Boulevard, and Christians were coming up to us. They saw my head covering, my yarmulke, and they were saying shalom. Some of them said Shabbat shalom.
We've teamed up with StoryCorps to bring you these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today, we're talking about faith in Appalachia and listening to some stories of what it's like to practice religion in the mountains. A 91-year-old man recalls being baptized in a river when a revival came to town.
Baptized us, and man, it was cold as all get out. I thought I was going to freeze.
What time of the year would that have been?
I don't remember now, but I know I like to froze.
And a girl finds out just how important her faith was after her father was in a mining accident.
It's hard to keep the faith in situations like that, but you kind of have no other choice. It's like you have your faith or you have nothing. And I'd rather have my faith than have nothing.
And a rabbi remembers the first time he visited West Virginia.
We're walking down the Kanawha Boulevard, and Christians were coming up to us. They saw my head covering, my yarmulke, and they were saying shalom. Some of them said Shabbat shalom.
We've teamed up with StoryCorps to bring you these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. During the holiday season, it's pretty common to see signs and hear songs promoting peace on earth and goodwill toward all mankind. So this week, we're airing a series of stories from Appalachians speaking about religious faith. The interviews were recorded earlier this year in our Charleston studio. They're produced StoryCorps style, which, as you may know, means that usually two friends or family members sit down to interview each other. So, in the spirit of giving and perhaps the holiday season, we give you a journey down memory lane and into the hearts of Appalachians. The folks you'll hear have different religions and backgrounds in this special Inside Appalachia episode, StoryCorps style. Let's start with a story about the time a rabbi moved to West Virginia 30 years ago.
We came for our interview, had no clue about West Virginia, knew nothing except for some stereotypes about what West Virginia is supposed to represent. And here we were on a Saturday afternoon, our Shabbat, our Sabbath. This is the weekend of our interview. It was March of 1986. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I just had a wonderful Sabbath experience at the synagogue. But we said, does this feel right? It's a small community. And we're walking down the Kanawha Boulevard. And Christians were coming up to us. They saw my head covering, my yarmulke, and they were saying shalom. Some of them said Shabbat shalom. Mm. And it was very inviting, very welcoming. Mm-hmm. That's the experience of West Virginians.
That was Victor Yurecki, the rabbi at B'nai Jacob Synagogue in Charleston, West Virginia. Yurecki was originally born in Argentina, but he found his home in Appalachia. These days, he's been inspired to welcome Muslims and Christians into his synagogue. And over the past few years, he's become good friends with Ibtisam Birazi, a Syrian immigrant who also goes by Sue.
I've been in Charleston, West Virginia since 1970. Raised my three kids here, and I call my West Virginia my second home.
Sue is also the vice president of the Islamic Association of West Virginia. Their latest project, called the West Virginia Interfaith Refugee Ministry, has attracted a member of the Charleston Episcopalian Church, Lynn Clark. So, a Jew, a Muslim, and Episcopalian walk into a public radio studio, the one in Charleston, West Virginia, actually. And so, just what did they say when they started talking about their friendship? Well, get this. It was actually their religions that helped to unite them. Let's listen to part of that conversation.
One of the things that I remember about each of them is how special they are in my life in terms of how they've shown me how to grow. Lynn, being of the Christian faith, approached me years ago and asked if she could study the Torah, the Hebrew Bible. And of course, years ago, that was pretty unheard of for a Christian to want to come and study it and be as a guest in a Jewish class. And she was saying, would I feel uncomfortable? And I said, well, that will be up to you. And she said, well, would you be uncomfortable? I said, no, I wouldn't. I've grown because of my contact with her. We joke about the comments she makes and, of course, from the Jewish feminist perspective, if you will. But I've grown as an individual understanding my faith. Sue is amazing in a different aspect, and that is in terms of her love of humanity. And I remember when my parents were at the hospital, Sue was the first person who was there to visit. And again, it didn't make a difference that they were Jewish, didn't make a difference anything. She was the first person, more than anybody else. And that touched my heart, but it also reminded me of the common humanity that we all share.
Absolutely, because they are a very lovely parents to start with. They're extremely, very, very nice people, number one. Number two, it is my duty as a Muslim woman to go visit the sick in the hospital. And so imagine that being your friends in the hospital. So you will go and you will be the first one to see if you can make them feel better or do anything for them. And I grown to have loved them. I mean, I do love them a lot. They're like my parents. I do. The Quran, which is our similar to Bible and the Torah, does specify the kindness that we as Muslim have to be to all everybody else, a human being. It, in the Quran, it says to mankind. It does not say Christian. It does not say Jewish. It does not say Muslim. It says mankind. And who's mankind? We are all mankind. Well, we do have a lot more common among all three faiths than we people think, because the message from the Prophet Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad is the same. Love thy neighbor, love each other, care for your community, care for each other, care for the sick, honor thy parents. I mean, the message of love and understanding is the same. How we practice, it might be a little different. However, it really, that's the common thing, that if we all look at it from that point of view, we're not so different after all.
Right, that theme of love,
yes,
is very important, and welcome of the stranger, welcome of the neighbor, and helping others. It's important in every faith.
For some people, the first step is always the hardest. I know I can speak from example here, coming from an Orthodox seminary, and then fresh out of the seminary, going to Charleston and being invited to a church, and I remember that first moment I stepped into the Catholic Church and how uncomfortable the image is. And I remember the first time I went to the mosque, because I've never been to one.
Right.
Could you share what your feelings were when you first went to a synagogue, or first time you came to the synagogue here? Maybe it wasn't there, or maybe the mosque. Because that's the challenge for people. They want to, but they're afraid to take that first step.
The fear of the unknown is really a problem, and lack of education and knowledge about a certain thing. And you're right. The first time I stepped into the synagogue, and I'm like, wow, so this is what it looks like. Okay, it's very nice on the inside. I felt the religion. I felt the peacefulness of the religion in my heart, like I do in my Islamic center. And the same thing with the church. Now, I have to admit to you, when I first came to this country, back in Fayetteville, Arkansas, I was invited to attend with my husband a Christmas service. And I thought then, as a newly person coming here, and even though I didn't really understand most of it, but the music and the love from the people in small church back in the hills of Fayetteville, Arkansas, was really, really awesome. And I actually start humming the music. So I was telling that to my mom, and she says, oh, you doing what? I said, Mom, but it's really beautiful. And I continue to love Christmas music. I was just telling Lynn that. So it's a peaceful feeling. I encourage everybody to visit each other places of worship and feel the peace and the love, because that's all you really feel inside it. I attended Marquita services. I felt nothing different. I felt the love that she's trying to tell, and the message that she's trying to tell her parishioners.
So. And I think there is more understanding now on the part of people of not proselytizing people that come to visit. I think that was an issue maybe up to the 70s or even more recent, that people didn't understand that respecting another's faith, and if someone comes to a church to welcome them and have them enjoy the peace and the spirituality without feeling that they have to sign up or change their beliefs in any way. I think there's more awareness of that today.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In some churches, I did get some like, what she's doing here. However, once they feel comfortable with you, then they've changed to welcome.
When you walk into a congregation, you can make that transition, that first moment of being very uncomfortable, to that moment where, like what you said, you get it. You feel the warmth. You feel the spirituality of the moment. Your life is transformed as a religious person.
You grow.
Because, people are afraid, well, what happens if I find myself being moved by the experience, or afraid about that, but it actually strengthens your own faith.
Absolutely.
Because the more you understand another faith, the more you're comfortable with your own, because you're starting to compare and contrast in a positive way. You're seeing the similarities, the commonalities, you see the heartfelt prayers that they're experiencing, and you, for being there, I think, are a stronger religious person.
You see, Lynn and I, ever since we got to know each other, actually, Lynn, as soon as I saw you and I got to talk to you, it's something about Lynn that made me feel like if I had known her for, years and years. And I have such an easy time talking to her. And I think we have so much in common. I know I am from a Muslim. I am a Muslim. And so I come from a different background. And as a Christian, I don't find that to be I don't even think about it, to be honest with you.
I have to agree that I liked Sue the minute that I met her. We met at St. John's at an event to try to bring awareness to the refugee crisis in the world. And I enjoyed talking to Sue immediately. And I'm also deeply touched that we went on a road trip together to Lexington, Kentucky, to learn about what is being done in Lexington to resettle refugees through the Episcopal Migration Ministry. And Sue didn't wear her hijab in the car. And I wanted her to, but she said that for my safety, not her safety, she didn't want to wear that in the car in case we ran into anyone on the road who might want to make trouble because Sue was wearing the hijab. And I just was so touched by that she would care about my health and safety and put that first. And also the road trip was really fun. We had a good time. It's a couple hours drive and we enjoyed it and we learned a lot. And I think we can bring some of what we learned and put it to use here in Charleston if we get the chance.
Well, Lynn, I have to worry about your safety. You're my dear friend. And I did not want you to be harmed at all by anybody who mistaken you for anything just because I'm riding with you. And yes, the Interfaith Refugee Ministry is where we started working together. However, it becomes a lot more than that now. And even if we stop working, and we all have submitted an application from Episcopal Migration Ministry to establish an office here in Charleston. But even if we don't get the approval from the State Department, I would still love to work with Lynn and Rabbi and be a long-term friend, because I don't think this friendship's going to go away anytime soon.
This is really what we always talk about with West Virginia. We get a very negative perspective about the state, about the people, and this is what really goes on behind closed doors, and we need to make sure more people know about it. I mean, here are Jew, Christian, Muslim talking, dialoguing, sharing, going on road trips, coming to classes together, visiting at the hospital. And it's not in New York. It's not in California and Los Angeles. It's in Charleston, West Virginia.
Well,
it's very common.
It's also about humanity. It's about getting to know the person and go beyond the book cover and the label. You know, I, as a Muslim growing up in Damascus, Syria, and of course we had the notion that, we don't touch the Jewish people. But coming here to the United States and encountering many of Jewish friends, as I told you in my work, and you have to look at the person, and you make it so easy, Rabbi, because you're open. I really, really admire your compassion for humanity. The hard work that you do, you set such a high example, so it's kind of hard for me not to follow you. You really, I mean it. And the fact is that you care so much. You don't care about the fact that you're now defending the Syrian cause and the cause of the refugees, even though you're getting some, some negative feedback about it from your community and other communities as well. And you continue to champion that cause. I mean, what better example is there? The Jewish issue, the Muslim issue, if more people of Muslim faith and Jewish faith get to know each other like we do and become friends, I really believe the world will be a much better place to be in.
That's Ibtissam Sue Barazi speaking with Rabbi Victor Yurecki and Lynn Clark. The three friends live in Charleston, West Virginia. This segment was produced by Roxy Todd. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear from a man who got his start in ministry while working with Martin Luther King Jr. during the civil rights struggle of the 1960s. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today we're hearing stories about religious identity in Appalachia. We just listened to a story about how a rabbi, a Christian, and a Muslim became friends. And next we hear from Ronald English and James Patterson, two ministers in Charleston. While thousands of people feel called to minister, not everyone can say they learned from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. himself. Let's listen to both English and Patterson explain that for them, being a minister is more than teaching and preaching, but it's also part of their ministerial mission to stand up against racism. Ronald English is the first voice you'll hear.
I think we have something in common, that both of us were born down further south. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, 1944, which means I grew up in the segregated South, went to a segregated school, but grew up in the situation that I'm sure you're familiar with, where because of segregation, there was a deep sense of pride in the black community, and also they were able to come up with the resources as well as the businesses that showed their self-determination in terms of how they went about taking care of the needs of the community. And a lot of times, we didn't know that we were deprived.
I can agree. I, too, grew up in the South, born in 1952 in a little town called Maxton, North Carolina. That was also during segregation. I remember having your teachers tell you that you had to be twice as smart and twice as quick as your white counterparts just to make it. Then in the 11th grade, the schools were actually integrated. And that's where we had this proliferation of academies, particularly Christian academies that were white only because there were white people that just decided they were not going to send their kids to school with us.
I grew up in Ebenezer, which was the church Dr. King, Senior and Junior, pastored. But growing up in Ebenezer, my father and I hitched a ride with Dr. King when he was still in seminary in Pennsylvania because my dad had a sister that lived in New York. Okay. And we would always go up there to see her. Well, we hitched a ride with him, and he was a little bit heavy on the gas. You know, he got caught in Pennsylvania by a officer for speeding, and he was taken to jail. And he told us that we had to catch a bus in order to go on to New York.
Was this Dr. King Jr.?
This is Dr. King Jr.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that might have been around the first time he was arrested going to jail. I just remember that when he would come home during the summer to speak and preach, we were always glad because he always much shorter than his dad as far as preaching was concerned. But that was my initial inspiration for ministry, really. And he was very encouraging along that line. I had that experience of knowing him primarily in the pastoral role as his assistant at Ebenezer, and I gave the prayer at his funeral, which was one of the saddest moments in my life.
I knew from the time I was you know, a teenager that this is what I was supposed to do.
I ran from it. I did not want to be a preacher. In fact, when I was a janitor at Ebenezer, I would hurry up and vacuum the sanctuary because I did not want to hear the call of God. But at the same time, the black church in particular was the bastion of liberation. It was what black folk felt they controlled. And the black preacher was not under the control of the white establishment that made it freer. And therefore, the source of the movement is no accident that it came out of the church and that Martin Luther King Jr. was a Baptist preacher. And that's because it was ingrained in the wood of the black church that it would be about the business of liberating folk.
I'm from the prophetic mode of ministry, which is belief that Dr. King had, as well as you have, that the church and preachers and ministers ought to be involved in the broader scope of the life of people other than just the spiritual side, because I believe that we are called not only to fight what we consider sin from a theological perspective, but we are called to fight injustice, and we are called to fight inequality, and we are called to fight evil in whichever way it comes. That's my calling.
That was James Patterson speaking with his friend and fellow minister, Ronald English. Their story was produced by Dan Collison and was recorded in our Charleston studio with the help of Georgetown University and StoryCorps. For those two ministers, religion and faith served as a guide for fighting racism. Next, we'll hear a story about how a spiritual journey helped one man heal after enduring racism. In this segment, Kanawha County man Ronald Wilkerson spoke with his friend Mike Youngren. Wilkerson talks about his struggle with racism in West Virginia and how his search for spiritual answers helped his healing process.
I grew up in a place called Gary, West Virginia, and I was in one of the coal camps, and the coal camps had numbers, so I lived at number 11 Hill. And from number 11 Hill, I could see across to the other number 11, a white grade school. But we would walk past that school to our black grade school across a swinging bridge. The schools were segregated when I went to school there, 10 years after Brown versus the Board of Education. There's 3% African-American in the state, but in McDowell County, where I grew up, we had probably 30% were African-American. It was the largest population of African-Americans in the state. We called it the Free State of McDowell because it was such an independent place during the coal mining era.
I know how important your mom was to you.
She was golden. We had a strong African village. Even though we experienced segregation, we had a strong, powerful communal environment where people took care of each other. We shared our food. We knew ourselves, so we were very confident in that way. My mother was one of the leaders. She had a college education. My father and mother both were college educated. He worked as a common laborer in the coal mines, and she worked as a common housewife. But my parents were leaders in the community. My father was a barber also. And everyone came to him for advice. They said, take it to the barber if there was a problem in the community. My mother, she eventually ended up teaching adult education, and there were a lot of people in our community that didn't have any skills at reading. She impacted their lives in that way and was highly respected.
How'd you get out of McDowell County?
Well, I was destined to go to college.
What do you mean?
My parents.
Oh, there wasn't any choice.
There was no choice. WVU came knocking on our doors in 1965. I guess they were trying to fill their quotas because there was not that many black students at WVU. I was a foreigner in my own land. I was in cultural shock when I went to WVU. My first overt form of discrimination was when I went across the street to get my hair cut, and I asked a barber there to give me a razor line because I wanted to have my afro looking clean and neat. And he said, I don't do it. I said, what do you mean you don't do it? I said, you know, my father's a barber. All you do is take the razor and you just cut around the edge of the hair. He again said, I don't do it. He said, there's a colored barber shop 3 miles out of town that you can get your hair cut at. And I didn't even know how to react. I was so naive. Racism was really rampant. I was bitter. I was outspoken. But as time went on, I began to open my eyes and search tried Taoism, explored African religions, had even explored Islam. It all brought me to the Unitarian Universalist approximately 6 years ago, and I'm 68. In the Unitarian Universalist environment, you can be what you want to be and express yourself. If you're still searching, fine. If you want to express, you know, your Christian belief or whatever you believe in, then you have an opportunity to do that. And you unite on the basis of what you have in common, and you work together towards common causes. That's what attracted me most. I'm still searching.
I think we all are.
That was Mike Youngren interviewing his friend Ronald Wilkerson. Their story was produced by Dan Collison. You're listening to a special StoryCorps edition of Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. So we just heard some stories about what it was like to grow up during the 50s and 60s. Now we're going to travel back to an earlier time in Appalachia's history. 91-year-old Harry Smith was born and raised in southwestern Virginia. His family's home place was uprooted to make room for the Blue Ridge Parkway. In an interview with his pastor, Ken Killen, he recalled when he was first baptized more than 80 years ago.
I was about 8 years old, I guess, at the time. And this preacher, somehow or another, he kept talking about the dead. And finally, that got to me. I said, man alive, I'm going to die one of these days. What's going to happen then? Because I didn't know.
Right.
And so when they give the invitation, I went forward and said, now, if I'm going to die, I don't know where I'm going. He said, well, we'll teach you as we go along.
Uh-huh.
And so from there...
And you were about 8 years old at that
point?
About
8 years old.
Okay.
And went down there, I don't know how long in between, but went down there in a creek, little church, and took an old alder bush, as they called them, and cut them down and laid them across the creek to make it dam it up a little bit, you know.
Uh-huh.
Baptized us, and man, it was cold as all get out. I thought I was going to freeze.
What time of the year would that have been?
I don't remember now, but I know I like to froze.
How many of you were baptized at that point?
It's about a half a dozen, best I remember. I can't remember all of them now.
Right.
About that many.
One of the things that I would like for you to talk to just a little bit in closing here, Harry, is over the years, how have you seen churches change? What's different?
Tremendous. I often, in my mind, and I have even stated a few times, we have left the Lord so far that I don't think we are really worshiping anymore. It's just a procedure. And I'm awfully afraid that... We've got television and radio and missionaries and every type that you think about preaching. They're preaching the word. A lot of them are, not all of them, a lot of them. But you hear it so much, and you just that it gets to the point that you get immune to it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe true Christians are getting so tired of hearing this over and over and over. Now, I may be saying wrong when I say it tired, but it affects you to the point that it really don't have the effect on you it once did.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
just changed so drastically. So much of our music is bordering now on rock and roll music. You don't have church music no more. It's just, and it ain't just changing fast. I was talking to a person down in Tennessee just the other day. They said, well, we're going the same direction. We're just losing it. It don't, just don't have the spirit, don't seem to be working like it once did.
Right, right. So there's been you've witnessed and you've seen just a tremendous change from the time you were a kid, whenever you were in a small white clapboard building with a coal stove or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And it hasn't all been good.
The biggest change that I saw in my lifetime has taken place in the last 5 years of going away from the Lord.
It's been accelerated.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see that on a national scale?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's all over that way. And I see these here big churches, so many of them in Texas, just thousands of people that I think it's just like I was talking about. It hurt it so much it's not having any effect on them. Because if them people were really, truly Christians and serving the Lord, that one of them congregations could have an effect on the whole country.
It's a change in the whole...
It's just not changing people like it should be. We've just lost it.
Right, right.
Me included, included.
I understand, Harry.
It rubs off on you.
That was Harry Smith speaking with his friend Ken Killen, a pastor at the Maxwell Hill Baptist Church in Beckley, West Virginia. Today we've been listening to some Appalachians share their experiences and thoughts on religious faith. They say to avoid talking politics or religion with folks you want to stay friends with, but with the magic of radio, you can listen without the tension. Plus, it's the holidays, the season of perpetual hope and goodwill towards all mankind, and perhaps a good time to talk religion. After all, many of the holidays celebrated during the winter are rooted in religion. Now we'll hear from a woman who describes her relationship with God as complicated. Patience DeWeese was interviewed by her 18-year-old daughter, Keturah, who was interested in finding out about her mother's time as a Jehovah's Witness and how her faith has changed over time.
Not only was I raised a Jehovah's Witness, but I was a third-generation Jehovah's Witness. So it was not only our religion, it was a big part of who we were. It was our identity.
Was there a certain point when you kind of realized that the Jehovah's Witness religion wasn't really right for you, or you didn't really feel like you belonged there?
Yes. I would say the shift started when my father got sick, and I happened to stay home with him instead of going to the meetings. So that created a space for contemplation, separate. And that led to start questioning things. And with Jehovah's Witnesses, it is the only true religion. So once I started questioning that possibility, the rest of it just didn't make sense. That is absolutely the hardest thing I've ever done, is make a decision that I knew would lead to being shunned by everyone. Imagine everybody you've ever known and your entire family being lost at sea. All of them are on a ship and the ship sinks. That's what that experience was like. But things lined up for me to go to college, and something I wanted but never thought would happen, and changed everything. Opened up my mind to a whole new opportunities, and just opened up my mind, period, to start thinking about different things and thinking things in a broader sense, something I never thought I would do.
When I went into my teenage years, I also kind of started to lean a little bit away from the witnesses. I think I kind of learned a lot from you, a certain open-mindedness to, even if you only believe one thing, it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody else is wrong. Like, there's bits and pieces and lessons to be learned from everything, and I think that's really important, and to not be so closed off from everything. From that point to now, what do you think are the most important lessons that you've learned?
When I was a Jehovah's Witness, I was not involved in making the world a better place because I believed that God was going to do that and that my job was to tell everybody that the end was coming soon and to become Jehovah's Witnesses. Now I don't believe that God's going to come and fix it all, that our duty as humans, the most important thing is love and care for each other. That's why being a Unitarian Universalist fit. is that concept of the importance of caring for each other and making the world a better place. And I liked how they have opened for you to question and to look at things. One of the taglines I saw is, come to the UU. We have questions for your answers. And I like that because my faith is very much still evolving. And where I was 10 years ago is so different than where I am now. And I know I'm always going to be in transition. And I found a home where I could be that way.
That was Patience DeWeese speaking with her daughter, Keturah DeWeese. Her advice to her daughter, have an open mind and be brave. Their interview was recorded in Charleston, West Virginia, where they both live. The segment was produced by Dan Collison. John Simmons' story began on the west side of Charleston, where he grew up. He's now a pastor in a church there. But a few years ago, he felt that God called him to travel with his family to northern Thailand for missionary work for 4 years. Here, John's wife Lisa asks him to reflect on the family's time there and what it meant to him and his faith.
Tell about what were some of the cultural shocks for you your first year in Thailand.
Well, one of the first things that they taught us was that outward display of emotion was frowned upon. And that you couldn't show anger. And frustration was considered anger. And so it was that was a culture shock in that, you know, you had to really guard how you express those frustrations, because if you went into the anger realm, you lost face and then you had no credibility in the culture. Mm-hmm. Other cultural things was positive was that in Thailand, they're very accepting of people for who they are and what they are. You know, they're very open to all different faiths and religious practices, and you know, their expression, you know, mipe and rise, like, never mind, just let's just get along. That was a great part of the culture there.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that sticks out to you that you found not only maybe just difficult, but maybe humorous as well?
Oh, well, elephants on the street with taillights on their tail. you know, it's a normal thing.
John, tell me how your time in Thailand, when were times that were periods of great struggle faith-wise for you while you were out of the United States?
Well, language school was definitely a challenge to faith.
Why?
Well, because, you know, I had been successful in ministry, mm-hmm, before I left, and had been able to share the gospel and to see people respond to the gospel. And then I get to Thailand and I can't even ask where the bathroom is because I don't know the word. I can't find my way out of my own subdivision because I can't read the signs. And they drive on the other side of the road, so I was always getting turned around. But to the struggle of learning language so that you can communicate was very difficult, not only intellectually, but emotionally, because of how it was taught, and it was a spiritual battle. Mm-hmm. You know, we joked and said we prayed every day for the gift of tongues, you know, and you never forget the first time you actually use the language in your work.
John, did this opportunity that you had to live in another country and to be able to share your faith, was it a positive or negative experience? And either way, can you explain why?
It was both. One, it was very challenging and very difficult. Mm-hmm. And very stressful, individually as well as for the family. You know, our kids loved it in Thailand, but growing up there in a different culture, different worldview, different freedoms. You know, it's a whole different way of raising children. But it's also a great joy because, you know, our work was to equip others. And, you know, we got to go back some years later and to see the people that were in the school where we had taught or the people that we had worked with closely and or a church that we had helped get established and grow and to celebrate with them, we got to see that our work was fruitful and that the effort was worth it. We also had to learn how to live in community rather than as individuals.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
That communal living was very challenging to people like us that are typically private. Mm-hmm. But what we learned in Thailand about how to work in different cultures and all that has allowed us to go many places around the world and do other mission work while we've been in West Virginia.
But I believe that it's also helped us in helping people in West Virginia learn to live and communicate with people from other cultures.
Yes.
Yep. Us being very insulated here in this state, we're very behind the rest of the United States in many ways in terms of dealing with people that aren't the same as we are. So I believe that that opportunity in Thailand helped us then to be able to coach people in saying, there's a bigger world out there, and that world is coming here, and here's how you learn about people, here's how you care about them, here's how you love on them, and then you go and share your faith.
Especially in the Hispanic community that you identified in Jackson County that helped the West Virginia Baptist Convention get involved with Hispanic ministries across the state and now planting two different churches.
That was John Simmons speaking with his wife, Lisa. Their interview was produced by Beth Voorhees. When we come back, we'll hear a woman talk about her struggle to find a church that would accept her openly because she was gay. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
You weren't born to be abandoned. And you weren't born be forsaken. You were born to be loved. You were born to be loved.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're hearing personal stories about religious faith in West Virginia. We were lucky that StoryCorps visited our studios earlier this year, and today, in honor of the holiday season, we're hearing these stories. Here, Kay Albright, Reverend and founding member of the Bridges of Grace United Church of Christ, interviews two of her congregants, Nancy Michael and Essie Gilbert, who are gay women. She asks them about their search for a relationship with God.
So, hello, my name is Reverend Kay Albright. I am the founding pastor of Bridges of Grace United Church of Christ. The United Church of Christ is a relatively new denomination in this area. However, we are about to celebrate 5 years of existence. And I'll tell you, the church planting is not really for the faint of heart. However, the great joy in planting a church is you start from nothing, and it's wonderful to see the seeds grow. The great joy is bringing people from all different backgrounds and traditions towards a common purpose, learning and living the love of God. We truly believe the motto of the United Church of Christ at Bridges of Grace, and that motto is, no matter who you are or where you are on life's journey, you're welcome here.
When I was in high school, you know, I was very involved in our church youth group. I was involved in Young Life, non-denominational, high school-based youth group. Very, very involved in that. And, you know, I would talk to other kids about how they were loved by God. But when it came time for me to believe that about myself, I couldn't do that. My first girlfriend bought me a book about homosexuality in the Bible. And I mean, it was remarkably a positive book about that.
Good.
Because she wanted me to be okay with who I was and with God.
What are some of the things that helped you to change your understanding of God in relationship to who you were becoming?
I think that finding and accepting and affirming church was the key. I mean, I knew that they were out there. I knew that there were churches out there that you could go to even if you were gay, but I had to find one. We were living in Oklahoma, and we were living in a college town, so I went to the websites to try to find churches in the area that I felt that Jane and I would be welcome in. And I didn't really find any there in Stillwater. Mm. There may have been some, but I didn't find any. So instead, we found a church called the Church of the Open Arms, which is a United Church of Christ down in Oklahoma City. Mm. So we would drive an hour and 20 minutes on Sunday to go to church in Oklahoma City.
That's awesome. For you, Essie, you said that you really worked hard to not have God stuff around it. Was it easy for you to find churches to go to?
I actually didn't necessarily find a church. After the first breakup with Jack, I had a best friend that I was hanging out with, and she dragged me, kicking and screaming, to her church. And it was an MCC church. And I walked in combat boots and shorts, and you know, nobody was going to convert me at all. And that was the same night, though. I mean, nobody, there were no harsh tactics or anything like that. It was really very sweet. And that was the night that I decided that I would just worship God for who God showed up for me, you know, how mm-hmm. God showed up for me. So, I mean, in that respect, yeah, because it was very easy for me to take all that stuff because I'd grown up hearing, you know, this certain amount of people, these people are going to hell, okay? There's the white devil, the blue-eyed devil, gay people. Like, there was this whole list of people that were going to hell. Mm-hmm. So for me to decide to take that and throw it away, that was really easy, okay? Mm-hmm. That was a really easy choice. After a while in that denomination, it was my spiritual journey that I felt I wasn't fulfilling, that I wasn't growing. And so wandering around, and you were right, it was the garden worship where and I wandered into your congregation, and here I am.
Well, I'm honored that the two of you have shared your life journeys with me, with us. It still amazes me how two people from such diverse backgrounds can come together and can find a home and can find a church family that all in one place, a place that kind of accepts you no matter where you are and embraces you for that.
That was Reverend Kay Albright talking with Nancy Michael and Essie Gilbert, two members of her church. Their interview was edited by Beth Voorhees. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. For our final story, we'll hear from 84-year-old Pasco Lansanese, whose parents immigrated to West Virginia from Italy. Lansanese grew up in the coal camps outside of Beckley, West Virginia. His parents were Catholic, but he joined the Protestant church when he was in his 30s. In this segment, we learn that through the difficult times in his family, he held tight to his faith. Let's listen as his granddaughter, Adelina Lansanese, asked him to talk about two of these events.
In 2007, your son and my father, Scott, was in a mine accident that crushed him from the waist down. Can you tell me what you were thinking during that time?
We were just praying that he would survive. We didn't think he would survive.
And once he was starting to be rehabilitated and gain a lot of his mobility back, what was your opinion then? What were you thinking then?
Well, we were faithful to the Lord, and I just thought that the Lord watched over him and healed him.
So what would you say about all of the people who have similar accidents happen to them?
Never lose faith. Always believe in the Lord and pray.
Mm-hmm. And what if it doesn't end as beneficially as Dad's accident ended? What if you don't get rehabilitated, or what if you die? You know, what do you think? Why do you think that happens to people, I guess?
Well, accidents happen.
Yeah.
There's a purpose for everything, Lord. And we got to remember that the Lord is in complete control, no matter what the situation may be, how bad it may be or how good it may be, that the Lord is first and always in charge.
In 2014, your son had a massive stroke.
Stroke, right.
So on top of the accident that we just talked about, what did you think when that first happened?
Well, when he had that massive stroke, I didn't think he was going to live.
It was really, really hard because the first one happened when I was home for the summer, and the second one happened when I had already gone back to school, which was like the massive one. And so it was really hard for me being away and kind of wondering what was going on at that time. And so I left school because my mom called me and said, your dad's on life support. You need to come down. And we all thought he was going to die. The doctors basically gave him a choice and said, we can take you off the ventilator, but you're probably not going to live. Or we can keep you on the ventilator and your quality of life is going to be severely diminished for the rest of your life. And confronted with that choice, I guess I was really afraid that my dad would choose to not go on with that quality of life.
Yeah, but your mother they wanted to pull a plug, but your mother said, no, we're not going to pull a plug. I want to take him home like he is. And with her determination and her spiritual background, he come out of it. That's what we got to remember, that your mother and the Lord had everything to do with it.
And she is so strong.
She's strong, and she's taking care of him like nobody else would have taken care of him.
And it's still a struggle because he's still not where he wants to be. He's farther than everybody else thought he would be. But he struggles a lot with being bored because he can't get up by himself or go places by himself. He struggles with his speech. He struggles with just a lot of things that I don't even understand. And so it's hard to keep the faith in situations like that. But you kind of have no other choice. It's like you have your faith or you have nothing. And I'd rather have my faith than have nothing.
That was Adelina Lansonese and her grandfather, Pasco Lansonese. Their story was produced by Roxy Todd. As we've been hearing today, people interpret and interact with religious faith in different ways. There's no way to include everyone's religious journey, belief, or faith, or whatever you want to call the spiritual connections in our lives. Rarely do we get a chance to listen to people with very different religious backgrounds, but radio, or at least this show, is an opportunity for us to safely bring those voices together. And as we've heard in the show, when we search out and understand people who practice other faiths, it doesn't mean we have to give up our own beliefs. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from StoryCorps. All of these interviews were recorded as part of the American Pilgrimage Project, a partnership of the national nonprofit StoryCorps, West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs.
The interviews were recorded in Charleston, West Virginia. Original music for this episode was composed by Matt Jackford. We also heard music by Dinosaur Burps, Lucinda Williams, and Hooray for the Riff Raff, as heard on Mountain Stage. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.